Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Oh, here we go again. The voices in his head called the rain to end.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast. Your If I Was a Boy, Then I'd Be the Boy of Music, News, and Criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
Review lets descend my plastic smile. But you should have seen him.
We're listening to My Boy Only Breaks His Favorite Toys. That's Taylor from the Tortured Poets Department. As you know, the Tortured Poets Department is out. Deluxe came out a couple days ago with Joe and I talking about the album. This week, in this episode, it's mailbag time. We put out the big call. I want to be honest, so many responses to make me wonder, as I often wonder, should we just go all Taylor all the time? Should we just do 52 weeks, 52 episodes, all Taylor? And one of the things that I was actually really psyched to see, so many first-time question askers. I feel like I know everyone's name who asked questions, and there were so many people who we're asking their first question, a lot of longtime first times, which I'm really pumped to see. So we're going to get into a bunch of esoteric corners of Swiftiana today. Some of you have been demanding the presence of Karen Gans, and Karen Gans, I am pleased to report, is here. Karen Gans, pop music editor of the New York Times. Hello.
Hello. It's true. I'm back. I was summoned like the ghost on Florida that Florence is singing about.
A very strange song. Everybody's so busy liking that song that no one's talking about how effing weird it is. So we will get to that. Karen is here. And also, Tom Bryan is here. Tom, the Don Dada of Stereo Gum, author of the first and one of the loudest and most pointed reviews of this album. Tom, how long did you sleep after that review posted?
What up, everybody? Happy to be here. Let's torture some poets. The sleeping was weird. I got in advance of the album maybe 6 hours before the album came out, as some critics did. And then I went to sleep that night, beasted out on my review, and then I felt a disturbance in the force. And I woke up like 2 a.m. and I was like, oh, okay, of course, here we go. It's a whole nother album. My review is now obsolete.
You could feel it. Through your slumber,
yes.
You could feel it.
Yes, because that's what it takes to be a music critic. You got to be plugged in like
that's
that.
What I'm saying. A lot of y'all, that's what I'm talking about. A lot of y'all are like, am I cut out to be a music critic? Do I have what it takes? Do I have the perception of steel to do this work? And if you didn't wake up out of a slumber, sweaty and nervous at 2 a.m., knowing that Taylor Swift had dropped an additional 15 songs onto streaming services, I think the answer is no. Tom B.
You don't have to be there. You don't have to be out on the street. You don't have to go to 10 shows a week. You just have to feel it. You have to know the vibrations flowing through the universe.
That's telling you
got a whole nother hour of stuff you got to review by 10 in the morning. So get on it.
Just got to feel it.
I didn't feel it. I have to be honest with you both.
You're fired.
I went to bed. Went to bed at 1, woke up to a lot of messages and Slacks asking if we were going to mention the second album in our story. And I was like, oh, God.
As some people know, I am like technically on leave. I'm on book leave right now. But I certainly would have been awake at that hour just because I was probably awake anyway at that hour. And I can imagine how I would have felt frantically texting you at 2 in the morning and being like, wake up.
Oh, yeah, no, I would have woken up.
It's like when you text me at 8 in the morning to be like, So something terrible happened. You have to get up and write about it. That those are our times. Anyway, we have, a preposterous, bordering on improbable amount of questions.
Let's go.
There's no universe in which we're going to get them all. There are themes that have emerged. What I will say is if Joe and I touched on your question unintentionally, unknowingly. We're not going to repeat that today. We're going to go into other corners. If you had a thought, listen to Deluxe. Maybe we touched on it there. I want to talk about, first of all, how many of these questions come from thoughtful, caring, true Swifties, not stands, but like real thoughtful, longtime fans. But I'm really struck by this one thing that's come up in a bunch of questions, and it really makes me realize how mainstreamed Stan kind of commentary and Stan strategizing has become in the normal sorts of conversation. So this question encapsulates a little bit of that. It's from Annabelle Winter. And then Annabelle says, is the double album release, rather than editing down to just the TTPD album, a conscious effort to flood the zone and accelerate the Taylor news cycle to get to, quote, Taylor fatigue narrative that mirrors the energy pre-reputation OG version, so that the Taylor's version album release of Reputation works narratively?
I don't think that was the goal. I think the thinking was that these were all songs worthy of release, and that fans have demonstrated a seemingly insatiable desire to have her songs. So why not give them more? I don't think that the fatigue narrative was anticipated, but I think it's real.
The craziest thing to me, John, is that I understood every word you just said.
I know, but that was my takeaway. Insane. Yes.
It sounded like something that you would need to like connect all the red threads on a dartboard somewhere to get to all that. But it was like, no, okay, I get it all. But no, I think I agree with Karen. Also, Annabelle Winter sounds like the name of a Taylor Swift character. I just want to say
think
that
it's a,
real
you
quick.
Think it's a gnome de pen?
I thought it was Anna Winter. Do you and think I was it's like,
Taylor?
Wow.
Do you think it's a Taylor pen name to ask us no. our opinion?
If it is, then that's the most galaxy brain like, shit I've ever heard of in my life.
In Annabelle Winter.
I think that Taylor Swift is existing in a state of perpetual flow where she is always working. And as someone who publishes like a 3,000 word essay every day, I can understand that. And
you are the Taylor Swift of stereo gum, like indisputably.
I mean, that's the nicest thing anyone ever said to me. Flood the Zone is her default setting right now. I think she is in the zone where she knows that people want to hear from her. At least a large, sizable portion of the public wants to hear from her, even if other people are getting tired of her. And she is going to keep going until she feels that she's tapped out and she feels that her audience is tapped out. And the early response to Tortured Poets suggests a couple of different possibilities there. But the thing is, sell it. Like, it's the number one album of the year thus far, and was within 48 hours of its release. So even a soft Taylor Swift reception is beyond blockbuster for anyone else.
I will say one thing about the numbers, though. Obviously, there was a huge number of pre-orders and people were buying vinyl and, you know, a huge demand to stream it all the first day. But I think a lot of it obviously was curiosity. What was this going to be? If you look at the Spotify numbers today while we're recording, the single has 66 million listens, and then the first few songs, 42, 39 million. But when you get all the way to bottom of track 31, we're hovering around 10 and 11 million.
Yeah, they're
million.
Not that crazy, the numbers.
Yeah. Yep. So I have a feeling that we're going to see
baby stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a feeling we're going to see some different Charlie second Booth and third numbers. Week numbers. Oh.
Yikes. My guy.
You're bringing the knives.
How dare you drag my guy?
It's not. No, his numbers are so freaking baffling that I hate to think about them. I get so tired. I just had to write another blog post about how Taylor Swift is dunking on everyone else in the music industry combined. She's like, you know, when the Big Show comes in at the Royal Rumble and everybody has to try and shove him over the top rope and they all got to do it together. That's if people were mad at Taylor Swift in the business right now, it would be like that. It's boring how dominant she is. And I say that as a fan.
Two things. One, I forgot that I have two wrestling super fans as guests. Yeah. I should probably just leave and let you guys do wrestling metaphors for the next 45 minutes. Number two, I will say, one thing, the thing that you just described sounds a lot to me like what's happening with Drake right now in a different form. Drake versus his antagonist, Taylor versus her competitors, quote unquote. There can be only one. And as Drake said, the biggest gangster in the music business is Taylor Swift. I just want to offer a mild dissent to the very level-headed, like, I'm a pro answers that you guys just gave. You're just like, I'm a pro. I've been paying attention to Taylor Swift. I know what Taylor's doing. Let's offer like a mild dissent. I do think that sometimes in life, and I'm not speaking necessarily only about Taylor Swift, I'm just saying abstractly, sometimes in life you feel a certain level of anxiety or tension or focus or energy, and it makes you do more things, which then replicates or amplifies the anxiety, which then makes you do more, and things get hypertrophied and more intense. And then that leads to a certain kind of music or a certain kind of creative or professional output, which then leads to a certain kind of feeling that people have when they consume that, which then leads to you feeling a certain way when you see how you are making other people feel. What I am saying is that the mode that Taylor is going in, I think maybe it's inadvertent, but maybe designed to trigger some kind of response that feels similar to Reputation era. It might be subconscious, but I think it's not out of the question that could happen.
I have seen online there's chatter that like this is all an effort, a conscious move to like go toward the Reputation Taylor's version. I don't think that's true. I think she definitely exhibits some resentment to her own overwhelming fame and the effects that it has wrought on the record. But I don't think that she's like, I'm going to make him sick of me. Like, I don't think that's in her DNA.
I don't think that she thought people were sick of her in Reputation era for real. I just think that she realized that she was viewed in ways that she wasn't totally plugged into. But I think she is plugged into the fact that some people view her that way now. Anyway, I'm just, again, not totally red-pilled, just saying that could be the case. Here's the sort of inverse of that question, okay? This is from Solveig Hertzum. Solveig says, I'm an early days diehard Swifty who has now, this year, after 15 years, gotten my fill because of the billionaire stuff and because it sounds like because Midnights was bad, which hard to argue there. Here's the question. I distinctly remember Taylor saying in an early 2010-ish interview that she'll only be around as long as, quote, people want her to be, and would retire into a quiet life when audiences stopped caring about her. Taylor has always toyed with this idea of stepping in and out of the spotlight on her own terms, perhaps why hashtag Taylor Swift is over party was so traumatic to her. But do you think she'll ever truly step away from the fame? Is TTPD the last gasp of her winner takes all year before she takes a real break?
It would be nice if she took a break.
No, but do you think there's any truth to that? Do you think there's any truth to the minute? Like, look, let's just call it from a numbers perspective. We're still going up, 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 up. We're selling 2 million first week. We're up. We're doing NSYNC numbers. We're doing NSYNC numbers in 2024, right? Do you think the minute that plateaus and starts to go down, she just says, I'm going to go produce movies. Bye.
No, she's an animal. She is, look, I went to the damn Eras tour, all right? She could have sold out stadiums by doing half of that.
She no, did not.
I'm dead ass. Like, her whole presentation for songs that are, you made two mellow acoustic albums and you're doing dance routines, druids. Like, it's a lot. And she does that because, to her, this is what a pop star does. She takes pop stardom very seriously. And she'll keep talking about making a movie or whatever. Maybe she will. But like, if you look at like Taylor Swift's filmography, it's not going to inspire, you know, any rapturous deep dives. She's really good at being a pop star. And I think she is going to continue to be a pop star for as long as pop stardom is available to her. And if this thing breaks, if she stops being anywhere near as popular as she is, she's still going to be the biggest. like it's going to be like Drake or whatever, where it's like she's going to be by default the biggest pop star in the world until we get some other like global generational phenomenon who is horizon anywhere flips. We'll see.
Chapel Roan? Is that what you're saying?
No, I sure didn't.
Chapel Roan episode coming soon? Question mark? TBD. TK. Potentially. Who can say, really? Like a lot of things about Chapel Roan, who can say? Next question, and to be fair, some of this next question was covered on Deluxe, but because of who sent this email, I felt like it was important that we put it on the show. And this email comes from a friend of the pod and friend of Karen Gann's. It's Jim Cantiello. That's right. Jim Cantiello is dropping a note. And Jim says, the only conversation that I've seen on Twitter amongst Swifties speaking positive about this album is related to song lyrics and timestamp things, etc. And that right there is the only barometer of quality. No actual discussion of melody or production. Easter eggs are the whole eggs, ... Is this not the musical equivalent of comic book nerds losing their mind? Now, and he's about to say some words. I do not know what they mean. That Iron Man 3 dropped a beep boop boop in the mid-credit sequence that tees up a blah bibbity boop for the Avengers. I guess here's the major difference between Taylor and the MCU. Marvel movies don't win Best Picture. Is Taylor and Taylor lore just the MCU at this point? Well, hi, Jim. Also, Jim with the big Danny Gokey shout out in the PS, FYI.
Yeah, of course she is. There's no other, like, there's nothing else you can compare to the extent to which she has dominated all pop music conversation for the last couple of years is the same as Marvel was for, like, you know, what, 2012 to 2019, I guess. And yeah, people got tired of the MCU stuff eventually.
But okay. But there's something about the MCU, and I don't watch these movies, but at least from the seeing the discourse, it's additive, right? It's we are going to plant the, like you said, there's a blippity bloop to set up a whole new franchise spinoff. And how do we have a movie that we could get Paul Rudd in? And how do we get a movie that we can have this other actor in? The Taylor lore to me is much more cloistered. It's much richer is maybe a tough thing to be saying in this particular album cycle, but it's much more like, how do we fill in the same space with like way more colors than how do we add and grow the size of the space? Unless I'm misreading what the MCU really is about.
As someone who has written about a lot of talent with movies, the MCU's issue right now is that it got trapped up its own butt with like multiple universes and self-referentiality. And there is a case to be made that Taylor Swift, who is an actual person and not a company making comic book movies and who is writing about her life, but it feels the same way where everything is a reference to something else.
Karen, do you watch MCU movies?
I don't really watch any movies, which is embarrassing because I was a film major.
Because you just watched Seinfeld.
I watch Seinfeld and Housewives and look at my phone, unfortunately.
And Drag Race.
Oh, yeah, and Drag Race. Shout out Nymphia Wind, our new winner. Part of my issue with this is I don't want to think about these characters so much. This is part of what my issue was with the album. It's like I really just wanted to listen to a bunch of songs. And I wanted some of them to make me feel differently. And I wanted my ear to hear different sounds. And I wanted different tempos, perhaps, and different instrumentation. I think Taylor's obviously a brilliant songwriter, and I am not here for all this self-narrative.
Okay, we've gotten this far into the episode, and we haven't... Look, let's be generous for a minute, right? I don't think this is any of our favorite Taylor album. It's certainly bottom three, I would say, possibly lower than that. But what's a song on this album that you actually really like? I'm curious to hear. Karen, what song do you go to? Is it Florida? Is that the one?
I have a couple of favorites. Florida is definitely number one.
Is that a bad thing to say in a song? Little did you know you're 100. Only the time you'll get arrested. So you pack your life away just to wait out the firestorm back in Texas.
Why is that song not good? Can you tell me?
What? Song is great, John.
Florence. I just Florence Welch.
Florence
Welch, like, she just jumped out of an episode of Ghosts on CBS.
That's how she always is. That's the.
It's never worked. It's never worked.
Oh, no. Love it.
No one ever took me to the Hollywood Bowl to see Florence. So I guess I just don't get it. Don't see it.
I love Florence. I felt like they interacted really well. I think that song actually has like a real energy and a vibe and a differentness to it.
They interacted like a bird and a ghost chasing the bird. And then the bird in turn chasing the ghost.
Oh, my God. I'll let you have that. I don't love all of the lyrics, but I like enough of them. And I do. I see a lot of people writing in a cringe way about the line about her friends all smelling like weed or babies. I think that's an awesome line for people in their 30s. I think that's extremely accurate and apt. And I liked it. It rang true. Although I'm now a person in my 40s, but still. And I don't know. The song just, it has a vibe, which so many of the other songs don't have.
It does have
so
that.
So I love it. I like So Long London.
Yes. One of the better songs.
And I'm just getting color back into my face. I'm just mad as hell cause I loved this place for so, so long.
The music and the lyrics support its dramatic sweep.
Yeah, it's got some like smoothiness. It's good.
Yeah. I like the title track.
Yeah, me too.
I like the first part of the album a bit more. I don't mind Fortnite. I like it. I feel like she harmonizes really well with Post Malone. I forgot he was on the song when I was first listening to it. And I was like, who is this? He sounds great. And I was like, oh, there you go.
This podcast is supported by Meta.
The world is facing a shortage of tradespeople. The metaverse can help solve that problem. With a virtual reality training platform developed by ForgeFX, aspiring welders can practice over and over. As a result, students learn the specialized skills they need to begin and advance welding careers. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
Post Malone better on Cowboy Carter or better on TTPD?
Better here.
Cowboy Carter.
Cowboy Carter.
He's in that like Morgan Wallen zone on Cowboy Carter. Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
He's fine.
Also,
all right, not less for me.
He's been awakened. Something that was awakened in him on Cowboy Carter that is not awakened on this album, I don't think. Tom, what about you? What are some songs that you're like, okay?
I think there's joints on this album. I'm not like, it might be my least favorite Taylor Swift album, and I think it still has some fire on it. I think she's...
Like what?
I want to say, I love Taylor Swift, first off. Let me get that out there.
Yes. For anyone listening, we love Taylor Swift, all of us.
If anybody has the 2008 back issues of Elle magazine that aren't online anymore, they know I've been writing. I think I Can Do It With a Broken Heart is probably the best song on the record. It's the one that I think has the closest thing to a new idea. Just putting her on something that's like house beat, I think is cool. And I like the way, like, it takes her utterly baffling, completely unique situation of I am hurting so bad and I have to perform pride and gratitude in front of all these people all the time, constantly. It makes that really compelling. I think that song's really good. I really like Clara Bow. The Black Dog, I think, is really good. There's joints on here. Like, there's songs that I'm excited to hear again.
Yeah. I got into my favorites on the prior episode, so I'm not going to overstate it, but just to, because I would like to blow your minds specifically, I do want to say that my preferred songs on the main album are the Dessner songs, which is shocking for the person that basically wrote off Folklore and said that this is not the wave. These Dessner songs, to me, are good. They're good. They allow Taylor to be as close to the Taylor that I believe her and know her to be capable of being. They nurture her most coherent songwriting, I believe.
Which songs, John? It's just...
I honestly think Love of My Life, LOML.
If you know it in one glimpse, it's legendary.
I truly believe that it's old Taylor. Impossible for new Taylor to be good. I'm just saying it's true to form. The singing is good. My main note, and again, I said this on the other episode, I am really struggling with the overall lack of investment in the singing on this album. The production is a totally different thing, but the singing feels really safe and restrained. And Taylor is not a powerhouse vocalist. That's never been her thing. But what she achieves within the range of her voice is quite impressive. I think that she's stepping back from that. It does feel like she's not trying as hard. With that in mind, this next question, which is actually sort of the antidote to the MCU question. And this I thought was fascinating because I did think a little bit about some of this as I was listening. So this question comes from Drew Carr. And Drew says, wondering how much, if anything, you think Taylor owes to or is being hindered by her more adventurous side of songwriting peers, Phoebe/Boy Genius, Mitski, Sufjan, Adrian, I assume Lenker, as the production choices seem to fade ever deeper into the shades of the same Antonoff-Desner colors, she seems more inclined to lean into the tendencies of these folks, formally, lyrically, etc., which, in my humble opinion, just isn't where she sparkles. She's not always sure how to pair seemingly unconnected specifics, a la the memory poems of Lenker and Sufjan, work concisely in the Mitski mode without ending up trite, and the hyper-specifics and humor self of Phoebe works only intermittently, at other times feeling like imitation as the saddest form of flattery. So what do you make of this? What do you make of Taylor's relationship to this class of songwriter? And I would add to this, how do you guys think about the sort of like specter of Lana hanging over part of this record? But start with this, because I think this is interesting, because Taylor is both, these songs to me are both very steeped in specific details, but they are not the classic storytelling Taylor, not as much as like early Taylor. They're detailed in the way of early Taylor, but the storytelling is not exactly like early Taylor. So tell me what you think about this and Taylor's connection to this class of singer-songwriter.
Taylor's songwriting to me is internal. And I don't really see her in relation to any of those people. But I was going to say that this is the first time I hear her hearing the footsteps of other artists, although these just wouldn't be the artists that I cite. I would say Lana for sure. I think one of my first notes on the first song was, oh my God, it's so Lana in vocal tone.
Yeah. And like a couple of the Jack productions, you're just like, okay, like I see the threads here.
Yeah. But I also see, and obviously this is a dangerous artist to bring up in the conversation, but I hear her hearing the footsteps of Olivia Rodrigo in several places on the record.
Absolutely.
I think that she has developed a new taste for the F word, perhaps in line with the younger artist who also appreciate it. And I mean, obviously I have a hunch why she held back for so long before letting it out now. But anyway, I hear these artists' footsteps more than I do Mitski or Phoebe or some of these other people who I feel many of them are actually, it's the other way around and they're writing in a more Taylor mode. I could be wrong.
Taylor Swift is making stadium pop music. Adrian Lenker is not her peer. That's goofball stuff to me. Like Mitski is this incredible music business success story where she's this cult hero. She's not in the same universe as Taylor Swift. Like, what are we talking about? I think what Karen said is totally right. I think the fact that she presumably like bites a whole Olivia Rodrigo like lyrical scheme on here and like makes it sleepy is very funny. I'm sure that's a sensitive area, but that's just funny to me. I think she listens to a lot of Lana, and I think Lana's probably been an influence on the last, what, like 5-6 Taylor albums. The people who she considers to be peers, I do think that Phoebe is one of those. And we know who Taylor thinks are her peers, and she makes playlists. You know, she like gets the people she really likes to open the Eras Tour. That's who I think she is in conversation with. She's not making this stuff secret.
And also she invites them to sing verses on vault tracks that make it clear that they are friendly, but lesser than Taylor. They are not peers.
Inheritors.
They're, yeah. Yes. my answer to this question is slightly different, which is, I think if we take as a given that the songwriting on this album, even though it is more specific, is also more fragmented. There are a lot of songs that feel like they're in parts, like, not to be like, this is like a Travis Scott album, but there are songs where I'm just like, there's three sections to this song. Taylor is not historically like, I have movements in my songs type of perform, but there are songs on this album that I feel like have movements, or perhaps are pasted together from maybe a couple of different parts, maybe in the studio, maybe by a producer. But I think if you're thinking about Taylor's songwriting through the lens of that fragmentation, again, I'm sure Taylor does listen, frankly, to these people, but I don't know if she's getting inspiration. But I think the fragmentation in that songwriting does not feel indebted to the sorts of unconventional songwriting approaches of this particular group of people. That'd be my guess.
It's kind of seems like the 1975. Like, is that fair
to say? Yeah. That came up in the prior episode. Like, there's definitely stuff on here. And the 1975, a great example of an unstable sonic idea of a band. Just like, we're making it up as we go. We're figuring it out. And there's a little bit of that making it up as we go on this album, this Taylor album, to say nothing of the last two Taylor albums as well. Okay. There's a lot of questions about where Taylor's going to go from here, but this specific question is, to me, it's a question I've avoided for one or two cycles, but I think is maybe now is the right time to ask this question. This is from Joel Blechinger. Forgive me if I'm mispronouncing that. Joel says, why do you think Taylor has steadfastly resisted, quote, returning to country in her official discography? It seems like it would be such an easy move and buy her an entire album cycle of adoration, both from her initial country fans and even from fans that have been fatigued by the Antonoff-Dessner sonic soup. Now, this is an evergreen question. You could have asked this at any time after the last like four or five albums, but I do think it's particularly interesting now because country is having an incredible pop crossover moment. Mainstream country stars are selling out arenas and in some cases stadiums in the same way that like when Garth Brooks was doing like arena country, people were like, that guy's not real country. And now everybody's, we love Garth Brooks. We worship it as all. You can see a country-leaning Taylor album moving in that direction and bringing people in at that high level. There was also another question about like country Taylor and country Beyonce, Cowboy Carter, which isn't exactly here, but it does make me think, okay, is this now back in play, especially after the decidedly mixed response and people's seemingly being over the Antonoff sound, especially, is this idea potentially back in play for Taylor circa 2025 to 2030? Is this the soundtrack of the Swift Kelce wedding, which is the Taylor country album? You think this is back in play at all?
I don't think it's back in play that immediately because it would feel like a retreat. Everything that Taylor does these days is set up like a war, and I don't see her ceding a position anytime soon. So that's number one. Number two is, I don't think that she would want to be seen in conversation with Cowboy Carter. She and Beyonce are doing this very deliberate, respectful dance. No, you're the greatest. No, you're the greatest. I'm showing you respect. No, I'm showing you respect. I can't see her coming to step on a genre like that so quickly thereafter. Could she return to this in a decade or so? I think she could. We know one other thing I want to say about the album, but I haven't had an opportunity yet, so I'm seizing it now, is that a lot of the songs feel actually adult contemporary to me. Which is not a crime, but it's interesting to me that in an album that's so much about like...
Says a person who recently interviewed Billy Joel. Not a crime.
He was making that music in his 20s. It's all good. That's his thing. But for an album that's so, where the text is so much about youth being fleeting and something that, you know, you need, time is running out in a way. So on an album on which like one of her biggest lyrical concerns is losing her youth, right? That he robbed it, that one of these men robbed her of her youth, which is obviously a concern for women who are interested in having children. The sound of it, it feels like she's pulling further and further away from youth. And I wonder if she will ever return to the sort of de rigueur of the moment pop sound of Reputation, which I think she actually needs to do at some point, or she's going to risk losing these younger listeners. I know there are a bunch of songs on here that felt like adult contemporary or mid, like mainstream even country. And in many ways, I feel like this album was aging her.
Sonically.
I feel like the sort of like Swift, Dessner, like Antonoff unit is kind of functioning as a band right now. Like that's who she's comfortable working with. And if she were like, it's not like Madonna grabbing a new producer for every new album. She seems like she's comfortable with these guys and it's so hard to speculate on another person's frame of mind, but like, you don't break the band up when you feel good and comfortable with the band. And I think that country music is always going to be a card that Taylor can play anytime she wants to. And I don't know that like pop bangers are going to be something that she can always do. I don't know if it's something she can do now. Like there's no bangers on this album. This seems like a very sonically comfortable album to me, to its detriment. And I think she's just working in a mode that feels good and to her and natural. And I don't see her jumping out of that until she feels like it, until like she feels like she's got to make some music that until she gets restless. She's not restless right now.
If she were to stage the next Eras tour, though, it would be challenging to find the stadium element from these 31 songs.
The first time I listened to this with my daughter, her first thought, who was a big Swiftie, her first thought was like, oh, maybe she's like doing this so she can sit down for a while, which like, it's not plausible. She doesn't have to sing so hard. She doesn't have to like do the splits on a car or whatever. It seems like the presentation of these songs, and I thought the same of the Folklore songs, but they don't sound stadium sized. They're going to be stadium sized because she's going to be the one singing them. And honestly, a lot of these songs I think are probably going to sound better live than they do on record.
Okay, I have some questions coming in about form. So that the album comes out at midnight, and as we mentioned earlier, and everybody knows, another album's worth of songs come 2 hours later, at 2 a.m. on release. TJ Flood is asking, essentially, what is the actual album here? Is it the 16 or is it the 31? If they're bonus tracks, should they be reviewed as part of the official thing? What function do they serve in this particular rollout? And TJ says, maybe these questions don't matter, but I think the 31 song drop has negatively affected the perception of the project as a whole. I wonder if the album would have been received as stronger if she had held the bonus tracks for a later date.
There's no question. That is 100% true. I'm proclaiming that fact. Thank you, loyal reader and listener. Even it's such a dilution is part of my issue. You know, everybody keeps talking about the muchness of it, but it really does feel to me like the main album is the first 16 songs.
I feel like every time there's a double album, the sort of like stock response is like, oh, if only they'd edited it down to just one album's worth of material. And usually I don't have time for that. It's like, to make a statement, what you got is what you got. This really does seem excessive to me. It seems like too much music, and there's a lot of these songs that I never need to hear again. There's a market for it. I'm sure it's going to like really juice her numbers, which don't need to be juiced. I think it really does hurt the album artistically to have this many songs, and I totally agree with Karen. It has affected the perception in a negative way.
Jonathan Prather has two questions that are sort of living at the intersection of Taylor, the musician, and Taylor, the human being. I'm going to give both of them because I think probably they can be answered in similar ways. Two questions. One, Swift finally takes on her fans in But Daddy, I Love Him. Sure, it's riveting, but isn't it frustrating that she only decided to take them on when they went after her? What about all the years of doxing and cyberbullying others? Number two, does Swift even have a history of thoughtful engagement with criticism? In response, she will probably just spitefully double down on what she's been doing. Could her anger maybe instead bring her to new and surprising places like it did in Reputation? I do want to point everybody to the song Mean, which was inspired by a Bob Lefsetz newsletter, yes. Which is a very unfortunate thing to inspire.
Great song.
I mean, it's a fine song, but
yeah, it's a good song.
All right, it's a good song. But yeah, Bob Lefsetz. Shout out to Bob, like a legend. But also, I don't know if you need to write a song about a Lefsetz letter. So what do y'all make of this? About Taylor taking on the fans, but having been silent when the fans were, when their ire was pointed elsewhere.
She's never going to write her Be Nice to the Pitchfork Critics song. That's never going to happen. Nobody's ever going to write that song. Not one.
Shout out to Olivia Horn. Shout out to Olivia Horn. Did a great job.
Yeah, yeah. And everyone who's ever reviewed Taylor Swift for Pitchfork, which is a daunting task. It's a don't, like, I was daunted a little bit. I've reviewed a bunch of Taylor records, and they've pretty much all been positive. And this time, it was not so much. I was a little terrified hitting that publish button. My experience with that has been great. Her fans have been, like, really engaged with what I wrote, and a few people have gotten mad, but it's been a whole lot of thoughtful responses, and I think a lot of her fans are not that thrilled with this record too, which probably helps. It's, I don't think that she'll ever engage with music critics other than perhaps Bob Lefsetz. I'm never going to be egocentric enough to think like I'll have some bearing on whatever decision she makes next. I think it's just going to be her responding to whatever's in the air, and maybe the reviews are part of that. But she's not going to, if people who are being like, oh, she should have done da-da-da-da-da, she's not going to stop flying in a private jet because we all wish she'd stop flying in a private jet, you know?
I've written and edited a lot of music reviews in my coming up on 25 years in this industry, and I've really never seen an artist engage with reviews the way she does, and she has over the past few albums, where she is recirculating the positive ones on her social media with hearts and appreciation and links, driving people to read those reviews and to share those perspectives.
And to not read other ones.
I don't know if she hasn't read some of her things or she's read them and decided not to promote them. Understandable that you might not want to promote a review that offers some critique, but it shows that she thinks that criticism is a worthwhile pursuit. And the reason why that irks me a little bit is because she hasn't sought to protect anybody who has written anything at mainstream publications about her when the fans are going on the attack. You know, it's very easy to say, I don't need you to protect me. I can take care of myself. And a bad review is not going to hurt my feelings. Please don't send death threats to people. Because she is telling fans that criticism is important. She's showing that it holds value to her. I find this to be an interesting paradox.
It'd be cool if she did that, but I don't think it's her responsibility. She's got a lot going on. But then I've never been doxxed by her fans. So, you know, I don't know. Perhaps somebody else.
I don't think it's her responsibility.
I don't recommend it.
No, the nature of fandom now really is toxic. And there is an element of the whole Pace thing. It irked me to no end, but that Pace published their review with no byline,
yeah,
citing the fact that a writer in 2019 who reviewed Lover received death threats. I don't recall that specific review, but I did scan the review for this album where I saw quotes taken from it, and it seemed less like criticism and more just like attacks. And so if maybe that's the kind of quote unquote criticism you're doing, then you have something to fear. But I think a lot of critics, Tom, as you were saying, did take this album on in a really serious way and engaged with it. The New Yorker, you, Lindsay in the Times, Olivia at Pitchfork, Chris at the Washington Post. I think a lot of people actually reckoned with this. And I'm hoping that there was less danger involved with it now. I think this was the safest album on which to have a dissenting opinion.
Right. But the fact that we even have to speak in those terms is...
Yeah, it's crazy.
Okay. Speaking of the reviews, there was this one, I think this is a really long email. And I feel like at some point in this email, this person says that this Taylor album is their favorite Taylor album, which, and in a very thoughtful way, but maybe I'm conflating two emails. Forgive me if I ascribe this to you incorrectly. Niamh Kelleher. Niamh? N-I-A-M-H. But this email talks about a number of things. It's very long, but then it caveats. It says, excited to hear your thoughts. Sorry this was so long, but I am defending length in terms of the album itself. But it talks about Ann Powers's NPR review. Frankly, I saw some lovely writing in this email about what this listener hears Taylor doing on this record. She's critiquing her own undying romanticism, placing us in her delusional shoes, revealing her embarrassing foolishness with dark witticisms and depressing vulnerability, and daring us to judge her. She's unpacking the consequences of her good girl complex in an internal sense, and the external one put on her, and how that limit on her humanity caused her temporary insanity in risking it all on fixing her new guy savior, and staking her claim to making her own mistakes and rejecting public ownership even from fans.
No, I like that.
Actually, very thoughtful.
I thought this was lovely. This was also extremely in line with, like, I was trying to think of if I had written something, like, what were the themes that were jumping out at me? This is very much in keeping with what stuck with me from the album. What stuck with me were these moments of Taylor sort of blurting out, like, let me cook. I'm a little bit lost. Like, I'm losing it here. Let me get through it. I got a deal. Which is, like, not exactly always how Taylor handles things like this. But this was just an incredibly lovely way of describing what Taylor is doing on this record, and frankly, through a much more generous lens than I think a lot of people have on this album. The email continues to say, talk about, like, fatigue with Taylor supplanting, like, actual thoughts on this album, that people are really responding to them being fatigued with Taylor. But the writer continues and says, as someone not experiencing Taylor fatigue, I found that having a really dense and complex record that's got a rich overarching narrative and loads of song connections to delve into, rather radical for her to release at this moment of universality. Oh yeah, and it has produced maybe my favorite album of hers. It is not an album for casual listening, and it appears much of her humor and self-flagellation has not been caught in some reviews, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I wonder what you make of this read, seeing it through that lens, which, again, I don't love this album, but I agree with this lens.
I think the lens and what you read out loud are more pleasurable than listening to 31 songs.
Ayo!
Part of what's great about this album, if I'm going to find another silver lining, is that it has inspired so much thoughtfulness and excellent writing. This is what we want. This is what critics want. We want to actually sink our teeth into something. So in a way, I guess we owe her a brief thank you for giving us so much to talk about. But I still maintain it is too much to talk about. And we could have talked about it in two more years, and it would have perhaps been even more powerful. Part of my issue, which I think it's not a unique thing, this has been expressed by many people about the muchness of it, is that you do have to go away a little bit to make people miss you, which is a concept that has been foreign to her for the past few years. And I know she felt like this overwhelming urge to get these songs out. You can get them out and not release them at the exact same time. I think it would have been a way more powerful project had she written these songs and then sat on them and then came back to them, perhaps with the wisdom of one or two more years, post-era's tour, post this era, and given us a chance to reflect on this moment. But instead, it's like a live blog, which I'm also not a big fan of. It didn't need to be so contemporaneous.
Yes, although I will say, to the extent that I enjoy some of these songs, I like that there's no wisdom. I like the flaws. I like the sort of, I'm not totally steering this car. I'm not totally in control of this car. And for Taylor, like the careful daughter of a careless father, right? Taylor is all about control, is all about steering the narrative. And I will say, in spots on this record, those fleeting moments of, I'm not really sure how this is going to end, that was probably the most riveting stuff to me.
Yeah, no, her singing about, like, making bad decisions, the same thing happened on the last Olivia record, where it wasn't just like, you broke my heart. It's, watch me do some dumb stuff, and maybe it'll turn out okay, maybe it won't. Like, that is compelling to me. There's a lot of compelling narrative stuff on the album, and My biggest critique of the whole thing is that just I don't hear this, like, roiling passion and questioning and questing and hoping for better things and, like, all these, like, big feelings, but the horniness, I don't hear it in the music.
Okay, three more questions. Shay sent over a bunch of questions, but I think this third question on Shay's list is actually kind of in keeping with where we're at right now. Shay is asking, does the new music change how you view Taylor as a person? As a fan since the debut, I personally love the album, actually don't mind the length at all. However, I was a bit taken aback by her choosing to admit the mistakes she made last year in her personal life and how she sort of lost her mind. personally, I'd take dating Maddie Healy to the grave. Plus, she called fans out for the first time. It's a different approach for her. So curious if you guys perceive this as a risk she was choosing to take or another business move. Now, I will say, I agree with the rhythm and structure of this question, but I don't know that Taylor is even necessarily talking about them as quote unquote mistakes so much as maybe missteps, which are not exactly the same thing, because those missteps got her these songs, which clearly she thought were good enough to put on a record. But I wonder what these songs, to Shay's point, make you think about Taylor the person. It's almost like in reverse rather than the opposite direction.
Taylor the person is someone who I've never met in my life. It doesn't change my opinion of Taylor the person at all, because I don't know her. I've never met her. The only time I've ever been in the same room was her as a stadium. These songs do not change that feeling at all. I think where fandom gets it twisted is that a whole lot of people think that Taylor Swift is their best friend, and she's not. Maybe this will change some of those people's opinion. That has never been how I approached her music. I feel like affection for her character on record, but I don't know if I get along with her. I don't know if she'd get along with me.
That's true. That's actually the real thing. Would she get along with you? That's really the question.
No, she'd be like, you're too tall. I'm the tall person. You need to leave the room.
Yeah, exactly. Not room for both. Not room for two tall people. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It makes me more excited that this is a person who has had a range of experience, assuming these are truthful songs, has had a range of experience that is seemingly different from the prior range of experiences and is willing to testify to that range of experience. That makes me more sympathetic to her as a person.
I agree with you, but I will turn the corner a little bit and say you can't continually keep sharing things about yourself and then being angry when people feel too close to you or like they have all this knowledge and ownership of your life. These are decisions. You can be very famous and people don't have to know where you are 24 hours a day. Beyonce drops these photos on Instagram. I have no idea where the hell she is at any time. She can be in New York. She can be on the moon. But there is something with Taylor where there's like a constant knowledge of where she is. You know, who is she going to be at the football game? Is she going to be here? Is she on vacation with him? And obviously a lot of that is beyond her control. There's paparazzi, but there is a level of famous person in the world who is less paparazzi. There are ways to be less known. And I think if she's reached a turning point in her life where she's a little bit curdled on all of the fame and the attention, that there are ways for her to turn that switch off. But then an album like this only amplifies it. And it makes me question her real intention with it.
For those wondering where Karen is at all times, Karen is on her couch with Richard the Cat.
Don't just send them to my house, John.
I just said you're with the cat. Okay, next to last question. Karen, I actually think this might be more of a Tom B question. It's definitely the most left field question that we got. This is from Ash Bex. And Ash says, the Taylor Swift album is 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 21 seconds long. Cindy Lee's Diamond Jubilee album is 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 22 seconds. WTF. Cindy Lee released exclusively via GeoCities and YouTube, where Taylor's album seems to be gaining the Spotify charts. Cindy Lee is arguably the most critically appraised album of the year so far. Just for jokes, I went to the Metacritic rankings for 2024 albums, and like Cindy Lee's super high, and like Taylor's like number 30, like under like Ariana Grande or something. I was like, LOL. To me, these two albums are at opposite poles of modern pop music, and it's wild that they were released so close together and almost the same exact album length. Are these albums in conversation, either intentionally or not, is a fascinating parallel here, especially with regards to criticism, fandom, and economics.
I heard it once.
First of all, who's listened to the Cindy Lee album?
I have, and I bought a ticket to the show.
Oh, okay. So we've all listened to the Cindy Lee album. Okay. Well, what do you make of this? Is there anything to be gleaned from the commonalities here?
When I had to sit and review the Taylor record, the thing that it was most in conversation with or in conflict was Drake saying, or no, Rick Ross saying that Drake wears Dockers with no underwear. I was like, when I've heard somebody say that, which is so funny and so specific, then is Taylor Swift's brand of celebrity gossip, am I going to be able to vibe with that? Am I going to be able to get on its level? That Rick Ross saying that has not left my head for 2 weeks. It's too much. Like that's too much to overcome. That I'm not really thinking about Cindy Lee. That's what I'm thinking about. And that's the mental static in my head that Taylor has to push through.
I think it's a question of people are so desperate to think about literally the exact opposite of Taylor right now, because she is so dominant. It is such pop music, and the Cindy Lee is not. It's really interesting. Jim Cantiello returning for a late part of the podcast, who asked a question earlier. He's the one who told me about Cindy Lee. And he said he was like a tinge disappointed by the Pitchfork review that it existed, because it was going to bring so many people to it that he wanted to tell people word of mouth style about it. Jim, I hope, forgive me if I am taking an Instagram conversation with you out of context, but...
Or as was once said about me on the ILM board many years ago, hey, Cara Monica, he f***ed the hype cycle.
But it's true. I think people want to... It's the joy of discovering something that perhaps everybody wasn't talking about for the past 24 months. I think there's a lot of, as we were just talking about, Taylor gave us a lot to talk about here, and we're enjoying talking about it. But people miss the moment where a place like Pitchfork could tell you about an artist that, and all of a sudden it became exciting and everybody was talking about it. So I think that's part of what's going on here. Also, the music is good.
It's a contrast between an album that you are being told is great from up high versus for an album you're being told is great from below. That's one thing. Also, these are two artists who do not do press. They are not talking for themselves. They are letting the music talk. Beyond that, I'm not sure I see much consonance, but I would love if there is a person out there who is going to do a double review of Taylor Swift and Cindy Lee. I will read the hell out of that double review.
Interesting.
I would love to read it. If any critics up to the task. Last question. It's coming from Ian Jane. Ian's got a conundrum. And I think it's a conundrum that we all have. And I think it's something that we've all been thinking about. I suppose my question, or really it's just a conundrum that popular culture will continue litigating and relitigating, is this. What exactly do we want from Taylor, if not to write about her life and her experiences in ways that she finds artistically compelling? She's traversed or drawn from numerous genres, country, pop, indie, R&B, and she continues to write about universal feelings through the specificity of her own experiences. And so I don't really understand the prescriptivism that seems to be coming from certain critical sectors. Don't write about your immense fame and privilege. Don't write pop songs. Don't reflect on doomed romances. Don't use high school imagery. Don't reopen past wounds, etc.
Bangers. I want her to make bangers. I want her to make songs. Yep.
Thomas, I actually have the answer to these questions.
Yes. You do, and it was in your review.
Where I want to punch a hole in the wall when I hear it. She's got so many of those. It for a while, it seemed like she could do it in her sleep. That's what I want. And maybe that's prescriptivist. I don't know. She can keep writing about high school all she wants. I want her to keep writing about her strange life perspective. She's a great specific songwriter. A lot of people are like, oh, get her away from Jack Antonoff. But like, they make Getaway Car together. That song bangs so hard. And they're not doing that right now. It's probably an intentional choice to not do it, but she could make some more bangers. I would like that.
Total sidebar, who's the producer of those bangers? If it's not Max Martin, who's the producer?
I think there's plenty of people out there. We can't have a three-producer system.
She's made bangers with Desner. Like, it's... I don't need her to go to A.G. Cook or whatever. Like, she can keep doing what she's doing. It's not doing it right now.
I really do like Taylor Swift, and I think she's exceptionally gifted, which is why I'm so frustrated. No, it's the same thing when people are like, oh, you're a Gaga hater. I'm not a Gaga hater. I'm a Gaga adorer, and that's why I'm irritated. Because
criticism
when you've proven...
Criticism is an act of love.
Yeah,
criticism is an act of love,
I've said this
people.
On other podcasts, but when you've proven that you can make songs on a bad romance level, and all of Fame Monster and most of Born This Way, except the title track and Judas. When you've proven that you can make tracks on that level and then you sort of like either willingly or unwillingly are not achieving at that level, that's what bothers me. And that is what is bothering me about the past few Taylor cycles. Although I think Antihero was the best thing I'd heard from her in so many years. I like Karma. I know you don't. I just, my ear was dying for one of those things on this album, literally dying. And that's why when I got to Florida, I got so excited because I was like, okay, we're getting closer to it. I don't think she's under any obligation to write about anything or in any style other than, of course, banger. But would it be nice to hear her engaging with the world in a different way? Yes. I'm not prescribing that for her, but I think it would be interesting. Lindsay had written a bit about Midnights saying that she really liked the way on that record Taylor had tweaked her usual concept of romance in a more mature direction, that she was reflecting on perhaps more youthful relationships through the lens of a woman in her 30s. And it did feel like this album was a step back from that, more towards this sort of fairy tale idea, which I mentioned this in a roundtable the other day, where if something doesn't end in perfect heterosexual romantic love, then it's not worth having. I'm not saying that she doesn't deserve love and happiness and that kind of ending, but I would like to see her break out of the box of at least making that the text or subtext of so much of the songwriting to reach for something else. That would be my request. I know she's not listening.
Oh, they're listening. Both great answers. I have two versions of this answer. One is that, look, the platonic ideal of criticism is I don't want anything from Taylor Swift. I'm just going to receive Taylor Swift as Taylor Swift presents to the world. And then I maybe will enjoy that or I won't enjoy it. And then I'll say if I enjoy it or I'll say if I don't enjoy it. I try not to be prescriptive in any way about artists. However, to the point that both of you have just made, which is that this is someone who we have been listening to, engaging with, thinking about, absorbing, thinking hard about for a decade and a half. And I think what comes with that is a bit of an understanding of what this person's natural gifts tend towards. And Karen, I think your answer is like, she has this natural tendency that I'd like to see her grow out of. And Tom, you're saying she has a talent to do one kind of thing I'd like to see her do more of. I feel like if anything, if there is anything prescriptive, which I don't necessarily subscribe to, but if there is, I want to go back to the thing that made Taylor very special and unique in the earliest years, which is a particular vocal approach that, and I mentioned this earlier in the show, it's a narrow voice, but there's a lot of emotion. She figures out how to get a lot of emotion out of a relatively narrow range. Songwriting, I think Taylor will always write good songs. These may not be my favorite Taylor songs, but I don't think she's lost the plot. Like I'm sure. No,
definitely not.
Yes,
yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure there'll be other great Taylor Swift songs. But frankly, maybe we're part of the problem because we're just like genre and indie and make a Joni Mitchell album, make an R&B album, but don't make an R&B album. Just strip it all down. Get rid of all of it. Pure voice, guitar, VH1 storytellers, just strip it all down. Keep it simple, stupid. That's, if there's anything prescriptive, that's my only prescription.
Our answers were all really very us.
I agree. They were very us, but also three very, really informed answers from three people with very different perspectives. Karen, what a blessing. Tom B, what a blessing. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Like and subscribe at youtube.com/podcast, where me and Joe are doing deluxe. Subscribe to podcasts. Anyway, get your audio or audio visual content. That is Spotify, Apple, YouTube, et cetera, et cetera. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Discord and Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcast, Facebook/podcast, Discord. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back in 2 weeks, actually, with audio only. We will be back 2 weeks with regular podcast with another guest host. And Tom, in honor of your request, let's listen to a banger. This is Getaway Car.
Oh.